Blog Talk Radio.
From their studio in the Feeding Arizona building in Youngtown, Arizona, it's the Boomer and the Babe Show with Pete Peters and Deborah Brown. Join Pete and Deborah and their guests as they give voice to 78 million baby boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Now here are the Boomer and the Babe, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
And I'm playing both roles again today, the Boomer and the Babe, probably classified better as the Boomer rather than the Babe, but the Babe, Deborah Brown, is not here. She's doing some things back at the other office, wrapping up some projects, and sorry to say she's not going to be able to take part in this conversation, although she has been with us more frequently lately than she had been for a while because she is getting some of these projects under control. And as that astoundingly familiar voice said in the intro to the show, this is Boomer the Babe Show. We are coming to you from our Feeding Arizona complex in Youngtown, Arizona, which is also home of the Valley View Community Food Bank, where the food is always free. It's Wednesday, April 25th, 2012, and at this fine day and time, if you're interested in looking for a 501c3 to lend your time, efforts, and money to, you can contact Jesse Ramirez, founder and executive director of Valley View Community Food Bank, and see what you might be able to do to help them. They're transitioning into a brand new, very large building, and they have plenty of reason and plenty of need for people's help. So anything that you can do would be greatly appreciated, and no donation is too small. As I said, I'm Pete Peters, and I also want to remind everybody that the Boomer and the Babe Incorporated is involved in more than just this radio program. We publish many books and ebooks, and many of our ebook authors have their own shows here on the Boomer and the Babe Network, and you can hear them all on Boomer and the Babe. I'm sorry, blogtalkradio.com/boomerandbabe, and they'll all be there for you to take a look at and for you to listen to. And we also produce videos and do promotional products and consult for small businesses. And our latest addition to our family of products is Boomer Experience Speaks online magazine. Many of our authors and guests also contribute to that publication. It's always a good read and always good and interesting information. So you can contact us via our website, boomerandthebabe.com. Sign up for the online magazine at that place as well. And it's always free, a new one every month to your inbox. Well, we want to get to our guest. We have an interesting guest today. The gentleman's name is Alan Kaufman. He has written, among other books, his most recent is Drunken Angel. It's a story of his recovery and continued recovery from alcoholism and his dive into the depths of alcoholism and addiction. And we're going to be hearing a lot of that kind of talk today about what really is that all about, and from somebody who has a very interesting background. Alan, welcome to the radio show, Boomer the Babe Show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Pete.
Well, as I mentioned before we came on the air, if Deborah were here, she'd ask you for your two-minute movie, kind of a little background. So I'm going to do that in her stead. So if you could give us a couple of minutes about who Alan Kaufman is and what you've been involved in your early days.
Well, I'm originally from the Bronx, New York. My mother was a French-Jewish Holocaust survivor. My father was an American-Jewish Bronx guy, kind of street guy. And so I grew up there. I attended the City College of New York, Columbia University, graduate school in creative writing. I spent 7 years abroad living in Israel, returned to the United States, and, in 1990, got clean and sober. I've been clean and sober for the last 22 years. And during that period of time, I've published 8 books, and 2 of them memoirs, one called Jew Boy, about being the son of a Holocaust survivor, and of course, the new one, Drunken Angel, and also a novel called Matches, kind of based on experiences I had. I served in the Israeli army, so it's based on experiences I had serving in the Army. And I've also published a number of anthologies. So, that pretty much sums me up.
Well, you have been one busy man, I'll say that much for you. And you certainly have an interesting background, and there are so many things to talk about that we could probably go on for a whole day, given the opportunity. Unfortunately, we're not going to be able to do that, so we're going to have to pick and choose here. Let's start with some of the things that you did when you were in the Israeli Army. That sounds interesting to me. You hear about the Israeli Army and how fine an army it is and so on, but what were some of your experiences there?
I just was a regular soldier. I wasn't a military hero. I served, during the Lebanon War, and I also served in the Second Intifada, during the Second Intifada. I was just a regular soldier. So, I prefer to refer people to the novel Matches to get a more kind of detailed kind of picture of what that was like. There's not a lot I could say about it here, one thing I can say is that certainly the Israeli armies and the Israeli soldiers are the most mischaracterized, military force in the world. I've never, encountered a more decent group of people than I did there. They really are comprised of the population of the state of Israel. They're a complete cross-section of Israelis. So, for instance, in my last period of service, my last reserve period of service, before going out on one particular mission, I was sitting there speaking in perfect English with an Ethiopian, African Ethiopian Jew, talking about sneakers in San Francisco, like what kind of sneakers do people wear in San Francisco? Very cosmopolitan, very kind of multicultural group of people, and very decent and nice people who are performing extraordinary, things in order to just exist. To protect their people and in order to survive.
Extraordinary tasks in an extraordinary area of the world.
Absolutely. And a very complex situation and, morally complex and difficult. But the bottom line is, that they are doing what they're doing in order for their people to survive, the state of Israel to survive.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Now, after that period of time, during that period of time, is that when you started to head towards the alcoholism?
Well, I think that I was always, and that's in the book, Drunken Angel, I was always drinking, and drinking pretty heavily. In fact, the period of time that I served in the military was probably, the time that I was physically healthiest. There was no opportunity really to drink. I did experience PTSD back in the 80s when I returned, to the United States. There was no question that I had PTSD. And that the PTSD was, I don't think, the direct result of my military experiences. I think that the PTSD was the result of the kind of childhood I had. I think that the military experiences triggered the PTSD, and in response to the PTSD, I began to drink. And I think that, drink heavily, like really heavily. And I think that that is a common experience for many veterans coming back from military, including American soldiers coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan, coming back from there, that they experience PTSD and drink or use drugs in response to it.
It's kind of like I drink to forget.
I'm not sure if it's really a matter of forgetting, but more sort of what happens is that psychologically speaking, and physically too, you know, there's a kind of interface between the psychological and the physical where one begins to experience extreme disorientation and extreme physical distress, and one begins to self-medicate. I mean, there's also a lot of shame and secrecy around memories and also around these experiences and the physical sensations. So rather than going to seek professional counsel, one simply remedies oneself. You know, one is hiding it from one's loved one, and even maybe at times wanting to hide it from oneself. One doesn't want to admit that one is going through this. Or ultimately, one doesn't really feel that, you know, someone else will understand. I remember back in the 80s, sitting in front of a therapist for one session, and I was absolutely sure she didn't have a clue about what I was talking about. And I didn't go back. I just didn't feel it. So I think there's also a lack of competent response to PTSD.
Right.
PTSD is a very still, you know, included. I was just saying, it's still an unexplored territory. There's a lot. It's amazing that, you know, we have so many military experiences, you know, let's say in the Western world, the United States, but there's so little known about it. You know, you would think that after, say, the war in Vietnam, when so many veterans were turned out into the streets, you know, by their disease, by PTSD, that a big, massive, you know, research would have gone on into what the cause of it. But no, to the contrary, there's very little done or known around PTSD.
Do you think that there's always been PTSD, as the World War II, Korea, and so on, that the military personnel came back to stateside from serving, and
well,
they
I think you know, there's different, you know, there's different responses. There's things like shell shock, right? They actually found that the best response to what's called shell shock in the middle of a battle situation is to actually, you know, after you've incubated the soldier for a brief period of time, you know, had somebody talk to him and have him kind of, is to return him into the situation, to return him into battle. That actually helps him the most. That's evidently what was found to be the case. But PTSD is different than shell shock. PTSD is something that sets in long after, you know, one is returned, or one comes back with it, and it begins to kind of unfold, in my experience. So I think that soldiers did come back from World War II with PTSD. I think that certainly had to have been the case, and certainly that was the case after World War I. You know, many of the writers who came out of World War I began to articulate an experience that was unknown in previous literature. Ernest Hemingway, Eric Maria Remarque, and Wilfred Owen, the British poet, trench poet, began to describe experiences that were not typical of literature, you know, about war, in which they described, you know, a kind of alienation and estrangement, not just from oneself, but from one's whole civilization. You know, one begins to feel a total kind of remove from life itself. That reduces a sense of despair, of crushing despair. And one experience, one read that about that in Hemingway a lot, and how to respond to that, you know, and so forth. So I believe it's been around for a long time, but it only first began to see real articulation after World War I, I think, and they didn't have a term for it then, you know.
Right, right. Well, there are many maladies that you can look back on with the capacity of hindsight being 2020, and say, oh, well, that's been around for a long time, but we called it something else.
Precisely.
We didn't know it as that. And so I kind of had the sense that maybe that was the case with post-traumatic stress. What is the remedy, or is there a full remedy for post-traumatic stress?
I'm not a doctor, so I'm not really qualified to say, you know, if there's a remedy or not, but I could speak from my personal experience in addressing PTSD was that, you know, first I had to address my remedy, personal remedy for PTSD, turned out to be alcoholism.
Your interim remedy there, huh?
My interim remedy, if you will. I had to first address that. And remove that from the table. And that was quite a, you know, that was quite a problem. That was quite a difficulty right there.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing for me was to admit that I couldn't do it alone. You know, that was the first that I had a problem, which was I was drinking myself to death.
Right.
And the second one, you know, is that I'm unable to overcome this problem of drinking myself to death. Alone. I can't do it alone. I need help.
Mm-hmm.
So that reaching out for help was the first thing. And, you know, if one reaches out for help, there is so many avenues of help that are available, it's not even fun. I mean, there's a lot out there.
Right.
And there's 12-step programs, which are free. And you don't have to sign up for anything. You don't even have to say who you are. You can just walk in and sit down in the chair and listen. Or you don't even have to listen. You know, you just sit there and just sit there. But it begins to have an effect.
Right.
Going to those things. And then there's, you know, a professional counseling that's available. There's many different remedies. There are many different things available. And so I really strongly advise anyone who's experiencing PTSD to first admit that, you know, the drinking is not helping. And the drugging is not helping. It's actually making it worse.
Right.
And that one can't overcome the drinking or drugging by oneself. One needs help. When one gets help for that, then one removes the drinking and drugging from the table and one kind of comes to one's senses, then PTSD will be addressed, you know, in a number of ways. Again, that's various. You know, one can find one's own avenue to recovery from that. You know, some may take a spiritual approach, some may take a psychiatric approach, or some may take a creative approach. Some may decide that writing or painting is a way to address it, you know. There's many different. I find that also being in the community of others who experience PTSD is very, very helpful.
Uh-huh.
You know, reaching out to one's fellow soldiers or to others who experience PTSD is very, very helpful. And so having a community is important. And one can develop these things over time. I do not believe that I've been cured of PTSD. I experienced PTSD on occasion. But the good news is that I recognize it. I know how to deal with it. And I can cope. And it passes. And then I can go forward again. But I don't believe I'll ever be cured of it. I think I'm going to have it for the rest of my life.
Wow. That's very interesting. The common thought is that when a person has an addiction, alcohol or drugs, that they have to what is said to be hit bottom before they can turn themselves around and start to work on hopefully a cure for their problem. Did you find that to be the case? I mean, is there actually a hit bottom? And how do you know if there is? How do you know when you're there?
Excellent question. And my answer to that is absolutely yes. I did hit bottom. My bottom was ending up living in the streets of New York, homeless, and, you know, lying on sidewalks with cops stepping over me.
Wow.
When they won't even bother to kind of move you along or get you on your feet, when they're stepping over you, you know, you've reached some kind of bottom. And I went homeless, and I think that happens to a lot of veterans. That, you know, I went homeless, and a lot of alcoholics, you end up disencumbering yourself or being disencumbered of all those trappings that make one a human being, you know. Mm-hmm. The disease reduces one to one's essence, which is simply someone who's drinking himself to death. That's what the disease does. It divests us of everything that makes us a person. And so it was for me. I lost everything.
Now,
at that point, there are many people who don't ever reach bottom. They just keep going right to the grave. Something inside of me woke up and said, I need help. I don't want to die like this. You know?
It's interesting that you refer to it as a disease. We have had other people on the show, medical people, that have also had their own addictions. I had one on the show about a week and a half ago. Very interesting doctor. Readily speaks of it as a disease. And I'd be interested in, I do believe, based on what she's told me, I do believe it is a disease. And I'd be interested in knowing your take on why you feel that it's a disease.
Well, my experience is that is, you know, I've been clean and sober for the last 22 years, and that has entailed also, you know, involvement with lots and lots and lots, I mean, unbelievable numbers of alcoholics, who are recovering alcoholics, and also those who can't recover. And what I see in myself, in my own experience, and in them, is that this is a kind of obsession of the mind, you know, and a physical allergy to alcohol. I believe I have a physical allergy to alcohol. If you put alcohol on my skin, it begins to tingle in this strange way.
Really?
If you would put a drop of alcohol into my body, my whole body would go on alert, and it would begin to crave alcohol. Once that craving, physical craving, kicks in, then the mind begins to obsess about getting it, you know. And once that obsession and craving meet, then the compulsion to drink is overwhelming, or to use drug is overwhelming. And then there's no turning back. Then I'm lost. So, you know, for me, the first order of business had to be in a recovery setting to have complete abstinence from alcohol. In other words, I can't ingest it in any way, drugs or alcohol, in any way in my body. Because if I do, it will trigger the physical allergy, which triggers the mental obsession, which creates a compulsion to drink or use that's overwhelming. I have no power over that. And once that begins, I'm lost. So that's a disease, you know. That's physical disease. It's a mental illness. By every definition, I think. It's undeniable. It's undeniable. It's a disease. It's not a moral failing, you know.
I agree with that. I agree with that. But I did ask the doctor this question. I'd be very interested in hearing your answer to it as somebody that is not a medical person. Alcohol is legal. So therefore, as long as you're of age, you can legally buy alcohol. Illicit drugs are not legal. So can you differentiate between the initial use, the first time you used the drug, a person has performed an illegal act. Beyond what happens there, the disease kicks in, the addiction's there, you're toast. And you have to deal with that accordingly. But discuss, if you would, your feelings with regard to the fact that the first time that the drug was done, unless it was prescribed by a medical facility, it was probably illegal, and how that plays into this whole situation.
Well, you know, I'm really not equipped to address that in any kind of, cogent way. I can say from my own experience that really I'm a dyed-in-the-wool alcoholic. In other words, yes, I did experience drugs, and I have actually two cousins who died in prison, who were both drug dealers, who died in prison of drug-related causes, and they both used needles, which gave them AIDS, and they died, both of them, at Rikers Island in a prison in Manhattan, and I have a third cousin who died with a needle in his arm, in his mother's bathtub, with heroin that was given to him by his brother. So, I mean, I'm familiar with that world, you know. I grew up around that. And there was a lot of it in my family, but I turned out to be a dyed-in-the-wool alcoholic. In other words, drugs did not really do for me what alcohol did. And I also, you know, I think there's a little bit personality difference between the drug addict and the alcoholic. I always tell people, you know, when they ask me, I say, you know, I never could have made a good drug addict because I don't have the business acumen that you need to really be a solid drug addict. I mean, to be a real drug addict, you have to be able to summon up, you know, huge quantities of money, you know, on a daily basis. And I could never do that. I'm too lazy, you know. I don't have a very good head for business. Alcohol, just walk in, buy it, and drink it, and that's the end of it, you know. And I wasn't a high-class drinker. I was a very low-class drinker. Right? You know, I would drink anything. You know, whatever got me drunk, I would drink. And so, you know, the whole thing of legalization, non-legalization, and all of these things, it's true, you know, that the prisons are filled with people who have committed crimes that are related to drugs or under the influence of drugs. But also, you know, there's a lot of drunks in there, too. Who have committed crimes under the influence of alcohol. Sure. It's interesting that both can lead to legal consequences of a catastrophic nature. You know, I met in prison, I was doing work, going into prisons, working with other alcoholics, not serving time myself, but going in to help other alcoholics. I met in prison a guy who was in a wheelchair. He was a young man who had lost both his legs, and he was in a wheelchair. In prison, serving a prison for a sentence of life. And what he had done was he had gotten drunk, gone out on the road, and killed by accident two women in their vehicle who were the mothers of five children.
Wow.
And had two husbands. So he had widowed two men, and he had orphaned five children by killing these two women. And in the process, lost his leg. And he said to me, you know, he said, the thing that's worse for me about this is not being in prison. It's not the fact that I lost my leg. It's the fact that I can never bring those two women back to life.
Right.
You know? How can I say I'm sorry to those two men? How can I say I'm sorry to those five children? Mm-hmm. You know, and you know, he's in prison for the rest of his life, legless.
Amazing.
So, you know, it's alcohol. Alcohol is lethal in its own right. That said, I don't want, you know, I never, you know, as a recovering alcoholic, would never suggest that there should be some prohibition against alcohol or something. Alcoholics, we have a problem. But people who can drink normally, bless them, you know, let them drink, enjoy, you know.
Right, right.
I don't begrudge people their right to drink, you know. I'm the one who has the problem. I don't consider, you know, the others.
Do you think the fact that you are the son of a Holocaust survivor has had an effect on this, this progression in your life with regard to alcohol and PTSD and so on and so forth?
Yes, I do. But I do want to say that my brother, I have a brother who's actually a fraternal twin. He's completely normal. No addictions, nothing. He had a little problem with weight. He lost it, you know, and kept it off. So I believe I was born an alcoholic. I think I have some gene that I picked up from my grandfather, who was an alcoholic, a raging alcoholic on my father's side, and some other relations. I think there's a gene that I probably picked up. That said, you know, growing up...
Alan, excuse me just one quick second, but that is something that Dr. Kranz also mentioned when she did the show with us, that there is a hereditary aspect. They have discovered that there is a hereditary aspect to alcoholism.
I believe that's the case. So I'm glad to hear the scientific corroboration. That's my experience. I mean, you know, you look at my brother and I, and, you know, he should be an alcoholic too, you know, given the social circumstance.
We talked about someday, wouldn't it be nice if there was a test, a blood test, and you could say, you've got the gene you need to stay away from, you know?
Yeah, that would. But of course, said, being human beings, we might be very intrigued to see what if, you know.
Yeah. She says, well, she's the eternal optimist now, and she figures that, that wouldn't that be nice, but the reality says, well, there's another side of that story. So I'm sorry, but I didn't mean to digress, but go ahead with your...
No, that's great. No, so I think, you know, I was genetically predisposed, I believe that. That said, I think that dropping me into the incubation chamber of my childhood, you know, was a great place for it to grow, you know, to blossom. Because my mother was, you know, as a result of the Holocaust, she, for the first 5 years of our life, luckily, she was pretty okay. You know, she was actually a wonderful mother. And then she lost a little girl at term, at 9 months. And she experienced postpartum depression of a really severe kind, serious. And she became kind of mentally ill. She became mentally unbalanced. And at that point, her experiences in the Holocaust began to kind of erupt out of her and erupt all over us, and all over, in particular, me. She focused on me. She began to hit me. And, so I experienced a great deal of abuse, physical and mental, as a child. My brother did not experience any. She focused on me. And very interestingly, I wrote about this in my other memoir, Jew Boy. There was a doctor who did a study who found that of families of Holocaust survivors, and found that in each family, the Holocaust survivor designates one child to be what they call a memorial candle, that person who will carry the message of the Holocaust into the future to other generations once the Holocaust survivor has themselves passed. So I really believe that in some strange, you know, way, you know, in an unhealthy way, but nonetheless, in a typical way, I was the designated memorial candle. And so she impressed upon me vigorously, both physically and mentally, the fact of the Holocaust with stories. She was a great storyteller, lots of stories, but also with physical and mental suffering. So, you know, all of that set aside, I think that's also part of what made me a writer. Did she do a good job? Well, I think, you know, there's been a lot of books, so something worked, you know.
Right. Wow.
I'm sorry I went through that experience as a kid, but I'm also grateful in a weird way that that happened. She gave me a story to tell, you know.
Well, sometimes you come out on the other end of it, transformed, but nonetheless with certainly more insights and a different thought process than a lot of people have.
Yeah, I mean, it's life. And, you know, I think one of the problems with our culture and with child rearing in our culture is we're trying so hard to create perfect conditions, you know, for, you know, our children and perfect conditions, you know. But we can't, there's no such thing as perfect conditions. I mean, at some point, the world intrudes. And, you know, it may be that my mother's determination to impress upon me the necessity to transmit the message of the Holocaust to the future may have been the very thing that saved my life when I was lying on that park bench. This urgent sense that I needed to live, that there was a reason that I had to, something I had to live for, that I had to live. I wasn't clear on what it was, but I knew I had to live. It had something to do about being a writer, and I had something to do, you know, still in this world. I wasn't ready to die. And that may be the very thing that saved me, you know. So,
I was just going to say that the Holocaust and always seems to be at some level under attack, as in the revisionist that it never happened. It just was, it didn't take place. And,
right.
We all know that that's a bunch of hooey, to say the least. But the point being, maybe it's a good thing, like you said, that you have that to take forward and to spread forward to other people, so people don't forget that it did indeed happen, and that the revisionists can just take that thought and put it where the sun don't shine. How does that sound?
Well, I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is that, and it's really a fact, that the revisionists constitute such a microcosmic, you know, infinitesimal minority in the human race at large that, you know, who cares what they think, honestly? And really, you know, I mean, while they're busy at their work of denying, you know, something that historically happened, I can't think of anything, of any activity that is more futile than spending one's whole life, committing one's whole life to denying something that is universally understood, acknowledged, remembered to have happened. You know,
right.
So to me, to be a Holocaust denier is the most futile experience known to man. And
well,
so if people want to engage in them, okay, let them do it. You know.
I think the thing that
bothers me. I'm apart. Now, those people are apart. The world, yeah, please.
I was just going to say, the thing that I think that bothers me is when these people want to take these monumental events in history and take them and leave them out of the history books as if it never existed. That I have a problem with. I mean, I've got two granddaughters. I want my granddaughters to know about what happened. So, because I do believe that if people don't take heed, that it's bound to repeat itself. And I just think there are certain things that we just cannot be repeating, period, end of conversation. And by ignoring it, by not having it in the history books, by not having a record of it, and not teaching it, we are doomed. The future generations are doomed to repeat them.
Well, you know, I completely agree with you about that. And, you know, the horror, you know, that needs to be avoided is, of course, you know, is not just the horror of submitting, you know, Jews and other people to this kind of thing, you know, to another Holocaust, you know, that's unthinkable, but also the horror of a generation of youth who will do that, you know, who will grow up to do such a thing. You know?
Right.
In other words, that the horror exists at both ends, you know, in the future, both for the persecutor and the victim. You know, it's for both of them that this has to be avoided. People don't think about that. They're always like, oh, the Jews, they're worried about it. But no, it's also about the non-Jews, the children who will grow up to do such things. That has to be avoided, too.
It's about
you know,
how
we don't want to see our children, our grandchildren growing up to be, you know, shoved into ovens. And we also don't want our children and grandchildren to see them shoving people into it.
And it's
something that needs to be avoided all across the board.
And it's about something about tolerance. It's about the way we treat other people. It's the way we treat people that come to this country and now are somehow persecuted for coming to this country. And maybe they didn't have anything to do with it themselves. They were brought here by parents or whatever. And I think we know what we're talking about. I'm talking about here. I don't want to get into a big political thing on it. But that kind of stuff, and when that type of an attitude starts to run rampant about, you know, your papers, please. It's just the last time I heard of people asking for papers, please, was in Germany.
Well, you know, I mean, all of us, are children, grandchildren, descendants of immigrants.
That's
We're
right.
We're a nation of immigrants. All of us. We are all a nation of immigrants. I've never met a single American who is not in some way directly or distantly descended from immigrants. And so, you know, I mean, we're a nation of immigrants, and so for the descendants of immigrants to turn around and attack immigrants is somewhat preposterous. I mean, it really points to this for me, that, you know, we are so inclined to project outwards blame and to point our finger at others. When really, you know, the real thing that ought to happen is the finger ought to point at oneself. You know, whenever I find myself personally, you know, finding myself extremely distressed about others, I realize that what I'm distressed about in them is really something that exists in myself. Mm-hmm. And that the finger has to point back at me. I have to see what it is within myself that's causing me this distress. And when I do address that, I'm able to look outwards with a great deal more equanimity and compassion and understanding. I may not love everybody, but at least I can practice courtesy and justice towards them. But that's contingent upon me recognizing that when I'm making, you know, xenophobically making the other person into the other, that really what I'm doing is avoiding something that I need to address within myself.
Right, right.
But that's just my personal experience. What do I know?
Yeah. Oh, you've got something to base it on, so it's well based. Let's put it that way. There's a whole page here of notes about you and so on that I have in front of me. There's a couple of them I'd just like to make sure that we hit on.
Sure.
One of them was that you have a daughter and that you were separated for many years. And was that due to your alcoholism? And then did you finally reconcile, and are you having a nice relationship now?
Well, what happened was that when I was back in my drinking days, when I was in New York, I literally woke up next to a very attractive lady in a hotel who announced to me that we'd been together for a week and that we were married. I had no memory, no recollection of having married her at a city hall, 5-minute ceremony. So we ended up staying together and I drank, a lot. And we had a baby. And when I was when the baby was almost 2 years old, I kind of drank my way out of there, you know. I did love the baby very much. But Isadora, my daughter. But I was very alienated, estranged from the woman and her mother. And so I kind of drank my way out of there and ended up in the street. Anyway, when I got sober, the awareness of my daughter hit me hard. And I felt that I needed to begin to make a journey back to her reconciliation and reconnection, if it would be possible. And I did. It took many years. Her mother wouldn't allow me to see her or speak to her or have any contact for many years. But over time, and many, many years and many efforts made, they had moved subsequently to Israel. So it was very difficult. But over years, I managed to go back to Israel to connect with my daughter. And we finally reached a point of great rapprochement where she was calling me daddy, and I was able to perform for her as a father, you know, various things that really liberated her in her own personal life. And so I'm very grateful that I was able to create that for her and give that to her. And it changed her life, no question about it.
That's good. It's nice to have that kind of an end to that situation that was going to be for a long, long time, if not if it wasn't taken care of.
I think one has to, as a recovering alcoholic or recovering addict, if there's a child in our life, one has to make the attempt to put oneself back in to fill that gap in any way that one can. And it may not be perfect, but in any way that one can, if one can fill that gap that's created in that child's life by the loss of a father or mother, if one can reestablish that in that gap, oneself in that gap, in any way possible, it completely changes the child's life. I mean, I think that my efforts to return to her life and re-embrace her, re-engage her, it really liberated her. It really, and she said that. You know, she said, "You really changed my life." I mean, the fact that you're being back in my life changed. So I'm really grateful that I was able to do that. You know, I mean, that's, you know, what one hopes one can do.
And you're to be commended for doing it, too, as a father and grandfather myself that has not been faced with what you have faced. I can only say that I don't know what I would do if I had to. If something happened to me that I would have that kind of a situation with my daughter, it would be drive me nuts. It would absolutely drive me nuts. So you're certainly.
It was difficult. It was very difficult. I have to say, though, that I didn't always do it because I'm a great guy. I did it bottom line, you know, because I had to do so in order to stay sober. There was no way my conscience would allow that to pass. I mean, I could not deny her existence or avoid it, the fact that I was missing from her life. I mean, I would have probably had to resort to alcohol to kill the pain of it. Yeah.
Well, there's no doubt that you had to exercise your demons, and I'm going to assume that maybe your writing had something to do with that exorcism of those demons as well. Is that the case?
Yes. I think that there's no question that each of my books, you know, there are writers who are very imaginative and they invent new worlds. That's not the kind of writer I am. I tend to it to be very autobiographical. And, you know, each of my books addresses a particular aspect of my life that has been, you know, all-consuming. You know, the Holocaust in Jew Boy, the Israeli army in Mattress, and now in Drunken Angel, my history of alcoholism. So it's my way of engaging with these aspects of myself and, in a way, exorcising, you know, performing a kind of exorcism, if you will, and coming to some kind of way of explaining it to myself, you know, in a way that makes sense and in a way that reveals truths for me. And hopefully in the process of doing that, create something that others can identify with as well. But it's a very personal act. I don't write my books. I never think about publishing when I write my books. You know, it's my agent that sells the books to the publisher and whatever, and I don't think about that aspect. For me, it's a personal act. I'm driven by necessity to write these books. I don't do it for professional purposes. The fact that it has created a professional life for me as a man of letters is a whole other thing, but I do it only as a matter of necessity, not because I want to, you know, get another book out there or something like that. That's never why I write.
So. Let's talk a little bit about the way things are today and the way young people may be reacting. Is it different? Do they act differently to alcohol than you did, or is it still a universal problem? How does alcohol affect the up-and-coming young people today?
Well, I think that what's happening is what I'm seeing happen is that alcohol these days is being almost pushed out by drugs. In other words, once upon a time, one drank and then just stopped or continued. You know, the majority would just stop, you know, after the crazy, you know, teen years or after college, say, and say, you know, sort of kind of buckle down and get real and stop the crazy, you know, drinking or drinking to that extent. Or, you know, they'd become problem drinkers or daily drinkers or whatever, but they wouldn't be dyed-in-the-wool alcoholics. And then there was the few who did become alcoholics, and, you know, they exist too. What happens today, though, is that the kids encounter both alcohol and drugs early on. In some, you know, places, it's mainly alcohol because drugs may not be as readily available or there may be more of a prohibition against it. And then they get into college, and they're drinking like crazy, and then suddenly it becomes drugs. And once it becomes drugs, they get taken down really hard and really fast. Like I've seen, you know, younger and younger people coming into recovery who have horrific stories, and they're not even, you know, 19, 20 years old. who have unbelievable stories as the result of using crack or methamphetamine or whatever drug that they used. It really takes them down quite hard. So what you're seeing is lots more young people coming into recovery than ever before. Alcohol takes a lot longer, you know. It takes years and years sometimes before it really gets to you to the degree, point where you say, you know, I need help. You don't have to wait that long. You can recognize that you're having a problem much earlier on and get help for it sooner, which is what I would recommend. Don't wait until you're in the gutter before you finally admit you've got a problem.
Yeah,
but,
well, I was just going to say that very same thing. You'd be sitting there on the curbside thinking, well, you know, maybe I've got a problem, but, you know, I've probably had this problem for the last 7 years.
Exactly. You don't have to wait till you hit the gutter.
Exactly.
But, you know, with the drug thing, that's something else. You know, the drug thing takes them down fast and hard. Fast and hard, you know. It has a different progression, the drug thing. And the drugs are becoming increasingly more lethal, more powerful, more addictive. We live in a very drug-oriented culture. You know, there's endless pills and more pills, meds, you know, and all these things that are written off, scripted out, you know, by doctors, flooding the population, you know. So there's a pill for everything now. So it's all around us.
There is a pill for everything, and just watch television. You can find a pill for everything. It's pretty sad state of affairs when the advertiser is telling you to ask your doctor to take their pill.
That
amazes me.
Yeah.
We're getting down to the end of our time here together, and I just want to touch on a couple of other things very quickly.
Sure.
First of all, you're obviously a very erudite, learned person. You have just an amazing wealth of knowledge with regard to this situation, certainly from firsthand, but nonetheless, you're putting it to good use, I do believe, and I think it's wonderful. But what would you think that you learned from writing this Drunken Angels book? Did you learn something specific that you could talk to us about?
Well, I think that, you know, in surveying the entirety of my experience from the perspective of my alcoholism, I really did see the degree to which it had impacted on everything from the beginning of my life until now. You know, you know, as a result, it gave me a great deal more compassion for myself, and also for other alcoholics. I mean, you know, really looking at it in this degree in depth, I gained a lot of self-forgiveness from it. It doesn't mean excusing myself for what I did.
Right.
You know, I recognized the pain that I caused others and the hurt that I did, damage that I did to myself. But also I gained a great deal more compassion for myself and a lot more forgiveness. And I think that's important. I think we have to forgive ourselves ultimately for being human and for being, you know, who we are and try to do better.
Yeah.
So I feel more resolved to do better, you know, as a result of having written this book. And I see that others who are reading the book is selling very well, by the way. And so
yes. Good.
I've been giving readings all over the East Coast and the West Coast, and people are getting help from the book. They're being helped by the book. So to be told that by members of audience, you know, that your book is helping me or helped someone I know, that's very, very gratifying. Very, very gratifying. So I see that even though I reached low depths in my experience, I can now turn its abuse for others. And that to be a service in that way, you know, is great. So.
What one piece of advice could you give to somebody that when they discover that and admit that they're struggling with alcoholism, what would you suggest to them?
I would say admit to yourself that you can't do it alone. That's the most important thing that you can do is stop trying to figure it out in your own head. trying to, you know, I'll change this, I'll change that, I'll go here, I'll do this. Stop all of that and find somebody, whatever it is, 12-step meeting, doctor, friend, whoever, and say, I need help. As soon as you say those words, I need help, it transforms everything. It puts your feet on the path. It changes your life.
Yeah.
So that's the most key. That's the key thing I tell people. Admit that you need help to someone.
Admit it to yourself. Well,
you have to admit it to yourself first, but then you have to admit it to someone else. It's really key. Key that someone else be involved in the process of you getting help. That's very important.
You have to say it out loud to somebody.
You do. You have to say, look, I really need help. And then two heads can do, you know, figure out a lot better than one and begin the process. Because as long as one stays locked in one's own mind, one's mind is the very thing that's generating the disease, the problem. It's not going to come up with any solutions by itself. It's only going to promulgate the problem even further. One needs another person there to help one. And as soon as one does that, one reaches for help. You know, it's a funny thing. It not only dramatically changes the course from one of suffering to one of recovery, but it also creates a new kind of bond with humanity. Like, it's really, alcoholism is a disease of isolation. You know, and when you reach out for help, you're breaking that isolation. You're linking up with the human race. And that's where the magic begins.
Well, Alan Kaufman, author of the book Drunken Angel, a very interesting conversation. I do appreciate you taking this hour to speak with me today and to speak with our listeners. How can people get hold of you, get your book, any of your other writings that you've done? Do you have some websites? How can they go about any of your information?
Well, the book is being sold. Drunken Angel is being sold in bookstores around the United States. You could also, of course, order it on Amazon, on Kindle, and it's also come out as an audio book from Blackstone Audios. But if you want to contact me, you can get in touch with me through Viva Editions at Cleus Press. It's vivaeditions.com, I guess it is, vivaeditions.com. Just Google Viva Editions, Drunken Angel, and you can contact me through them. They will definitely, my publisher, they'll definitely refer the email to me.
And you give readings and speaking engagements and so on as well, I would imagine?
I do. I've been doing them all over the West Coast and around the East Coast. Right now I'm back on the West Coast, and we'll be doing more readings. And those will be posted on the Viva Editions, the publisher's website. The Viva Editions Cleus Press.
Very good, very good. Well, once again, thank you, Alan, for being our guest today, and I look forward to talking to you again in the very near future, and I'll be giving you a call shortly after this show, and I'll let you know what we can do with this radio program and how you can take it down and so on if you're interested in doing that. So thanks again for joining us.
Thank you, Peter. It was a pleasure.
My pleasure, believe me. And thank you, everybody, for listening today. Also, as always, we try to bring you some interesting conversation and interesting information at Boomer the Babe Show. We certainly did that today with author Alan Kaufman, author of Drunken Angel. And we thank you for listening to us on Blog Talk. And we'll be back again tomorrow for another Blog Talk edition. So you can listen to us every Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock right here on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, we do much more than host this radio show on Blog Talk. Check us out at BoomerTheBabe.com. See everything that makes up the Boomer the Babe. Please sign up for our online magazine, Boomer Experience Speaks. Remember, Alan Kaufman is the author. Drunken Angel is the book. Be sure to make the second half of your life the best half of your life, and we'll see you tomorrow with another great guest. Thanks for listening.
To the Boomer the Babe Show, where we bring interesting conversation to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as Pete Peters 47.
As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerandthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.